It's the dawning of a new era. It's the dawning of the age of Aquarius and more. It is a new The Punkish Podcast. Hallie Bullitt has gone into retirement and may pop up here or there. We'll see. Generally, when people go into retirement, they kind of stick to it and don't come back. But you never know, Hallie Bullitt. I mean, and more, you never know. So are you,
you never
happy?
Know.
Are you sad? How are you feeling now that Hallie has left us?
I was really surprised when she's like, oh, I'm going to be like leaving the podcast because, you know, it's surprising when like people leave. But I mean, at the same time, it's of course there's a lot going on. And I think the way that she decided to leave and announced everything was very good. So I feel a lot of closure that way. And again, like it felt more like a see you later instead of a goodbye, if that makes sense. Like, you know, she'll be popping up if she wants to. Like that option's always open. So that's really cool. So I'm a little sad, but I know that it's for the best because I wouldn't want to see like her push through and try to like be there for the podcast when she doesn't have the energy to. So I think it was smart, and I think that if she feels like she wants to do it again, you know, she knows the door is always open. What about you?
I'm sad that Hallie Bullitt is gone. I understand.
Yeah.
But I'm sad. What can I say? So yeah, it's a bummer, but you know, change is good and change is constant, and you can't fight change. And there's some quote about change that I'm trying to think of. The only thing that doesn't change is change or something like that. There's
the
some
only constant.
The only constant is change. So they go, or there's the other phrase, you can never put your foot in the same river twice. What do you think of that quote, and more?
Ooh, that's very, very interesting because the water is always fresh and the water is always new.
That's right. So, I mean, one of the cool things about the Punk News podcast is that it is always changing. And I am now, you know, I think the listeners don't care at all. I'm going to give the oral history of the Punk News podcast because I'm fascinated by it. The Punk News podcast. Yeah. And then more, do you know the full history of the Punk News podcast?
I don't. I only know part of it. So I'm excited to hear the full history.
So the Punk News actually was on the podcast game before podcasts even existed. What happened was a long time ago, we had an editor called Rich Verducci or Dante 3000. And he was actually one of the first main editors of Punk News from 2001 to like 2004, 2005. And he had a website called Sound Scene Revolution. And he did that website with sound guy Narriman, who wasn't even into punk rock at all. He just knew Rich and liked doing audio engineering. And so they had a website where Rich would interview people and sound guy Narriman would record it, and they would put those recordings up on the website, which was basically a podcast, and that you would go to the website and listen to an MP3 of the interview. Then when podcasts were like brand new, Rich, Chris Moran, and Brian Yancey decided to do a podcast for Punk News. So the Sound Scene Revolution show became the Punk News podcast. Pretty soon thereafter, Adam White joined. And then they would kind of have a rotating cast of Rich, Adam White, Brian Yancey, Justin August, and I think maybe even Auburn was on a few times, believe it or not.
Cool.
And then after not that long, Kira joined, and Britt Strummer, RIP, was on. And around that time, Rich kind of faded out. And Sound Guy Narriman actually stuck around after Rich left, even though he was Rich's friend. He stuck around for us, which was pretty cool. Kira stopped being a podcast. I stopped working at Punk News at about 2011 or 12, I think. Around that time, Sam Barrett joined and wasn't really on the podcast too much, but she was part of the show. And then I remember specifically around that time, about episode 50 of the Punk News podcast, and now we're way up to like episode 650. There was the story where Harley Flanagan went to CBGB's and had a knife with him and got a big fist fight with some people and stabbed some people and got injured and went to jail. And I demanded to go on the podcast because I had very strong feelings about that. And it's astoundingly amusing to me. I'm not going to reiterate them. My opinion as of the parties then, as opposed to my opinion in the parties now. I will say I like Harley a lot. I think he's a cool guy, an amazing musician, and a very intelligent guy. And so it's hilarious to listen to my interview, my opinion back then, as opposed to now. It just shows that anything can change. And so about episode 50 was the first episode that I was on, and then I was on here or there. And then at about episode 100 is when Brian Yancey left the podcast. He left Punk News. And so then it was – that's right. And then so Yancey left, and he was kind of the podcast organizer at the time. And so the podcast at about episode 100 was going to end because Yancey was gone. No one was really running it. Rich was gone. Kira was gone. And so it was – Adam was kind of hanging out, but he wasn't driving the podcast. And I'm trying to think – and so Britt Sherman was on once in a while. Britt Reiser was on once in a while. And Chris Mann was on once in a long, long while. And Justin August was long gone. And it's funny, if you go into like the Punk News editorial thing and like Google Justin August or Rich Verducci, the conversations they were having back in like 2007, 2008 are just, they feel so amazingly antiquated. It's so interesting how much things can change in 14 years. It's like crazy. Anyways, so they left, and so there was no one to take care of the podcast, and actually there was no one to run the reviews. And so I said, well, I'll just run the reviews, meaning I'll just do it this week. And then somehow I ended up running reviews for like 5 or 6 years. And then I got slightly confused.
Okay.
Joe Pallone was doing reviews. He left. Brian Yancey started doing reviews. And then Brian Yancey was leaving. So the podcast had no driver and was about to stop. Okay. And there was no reviews. And actually, if the readers might remember, there was 1 week at Punk News where there was no news posted at all. And so I said, well, I'll just help out. And so I started posting news and I started doing reviews, and I ended up being like the reviews editor for like 7 years. And then Jeff took over for a number of years. And then I think Yancey might even come back. And then they both left. And so then I'm doing reviews again, which I don't really want to be doing, but that's a whole different story. So anyways, but at about episode 100, just after episode 100, Yancey left and the podcast was about to end. And so I said to Adam, well, let's just keep it going. And then Adam and I did a podcast as the main guys with a rotating and that's when Ricky came in and Tom Trauma came in and Sam Barrett came in. So from about episode 150 or so through episode 350, it was always me and Adam with Tom Trauma and Ricky pretty much switching in and out every other week. And then Sam would come by once in a while. Britt Strummer would come by once in a long while. And who am I missing? Sam, I guess that's it. So that was the podcast. And then M. Moore joined around episode – M. Moore, you joined around episode 350 or 400 or something?
It was like mid-400s, I think.
So that's when M. Moore started jumping on. And actually, we had Hallie on as a guest. I know we had her on before as part of – not the Unlovables, but as part of Hiccup. But I can't remember why we had her on as a guest. But she was on as a guest, you know, about once a month or so. And then Tom left and then Adam left. So we said – and then M. Moore was more of a constant person. So then we said to Hallie, do you want to come be a permanent member? And Hallie said yes, which was totally awesome and definitely gave the podcast a new dynamic. And so then it was me, Hallie Bullitt, M. Moore, and Sam Barrett once in a while from about 500 to about 650 or so. Maybe more like 550 to 650 or so. And now it's me and Em and Sammy B. And that's the history of Punk News Podcast. And the cool thing about the Punk News Podcast, like I said, is it changes and has a different feel. If you listen to some of those old episodes, the feel is so different. I love those like early episodes. It's like, and the Lawrence Arms have released a new track. Kira, what do you think? Well, I think blah, blah, blah. Brian, what do you think? Well, I think blah, blah, blah. Justin, what do you think? Well, I think blah, blah, blah. Our next story is Operation Ivy are reissuing their only album. Brian, what do you think? Blah, blah, blah. You know, so it's so funny. And then it got looser and more fluid as it went on. And you know, we had actually around episode 300, we were doing lots of wacky episodes, which I really enjoyed. We were doing like game shows and just kind of goofy stuff. We had the Track Keeper on, and we did the All Ska episode. We did the All Grindcore episode. We did the New Metal episode, which was that was me, Adam, and Tom and Ricky, and that had kind of a bro-y feel, which I enjoyed, frankly. And then after those guys left, we brought in like, Hallie and Em and Sam. And it definitely had a different vibe, which actually I enjoyed that too, because you don't want to become too bro either. That can get kind of weird. So the Pungus podcast is always changing. The feel is always changing. And I don't think you can force it. I just think it has to kind of happen naturally and see what happens. But the question is, Emmore, what should we do going forward now? Should we just do you, me, and Sam? Should we have a guest on every week? Should we bring in a new person? Should we totally stop doing news and just kind of chit-chat? Or should we do some news and a lot of special stuff like Album of the Week or whatever? Should we end the podcast? Should we change the podcast into the M Moore Show? I'm serious, Em. What do you think we should do?
We have to keep going. Like, we have to keep doing the podcast. I really enjoy doing the podcast. Like, when I first came on, like, it was usually just like you, me, and Adam, and that was really cool. And then when he left and Hallie came on, and that was really awesome too. And when Sam's on, like, that's super cool.
Yeah, I am gonna miss Hallie. I really am. You know what I mean? But well, what can you do? She doesn't love us anymore, and she doesn't love us anymore.
No. Yeah, it's harder than I thought it was gonna be, to be honest. It's
What do you mean, the podcast or Hallie leaving?
Hallie leaving. Yeah, because, like, you know, you talk to somebody like for weekly for years, right? And it kind of like builds up. So, but yeah, no, the podcast needs to continue. I think we're going to find like a whole new dynamic. I don't know what that's going to be like yet. I think it'll take a little bit to kind of like, you know, find the vibe. But I really like doing the more like wacky episodes. Like, I like doing the game shows and specialty episodes, like the album battles and stuff like that. I think we should do like some more of those, and having guests on is always really fun. So I think we should do like the odd guest spot and just have a mix of things, like keep the news, because I think the news is important. And it's fun to talk about like a lot of stuff, because again, like, we'll be talking and it'll go in different directions that like maybe I wasn't thinking about, or things I wasn't aware of with some of the bands, like when you and Hallie had the whole Men Without Hats thing. And it was like, well, I only know like one song by them, but they have like a bunch of stuff, so that was really interesting, you know, like stuff like that. It just evolves naturally. I also like the episodes where we just kind of like, you know, like shoot the shit and talk about different things.
Those are my favorite, but I'm always worried about it becoming too self-indulgent. Like, I would love to do that every week, but I feel like that might, like, then why are people listening if we're just talking about like bullshit? You know what I mean?
We should have like a spinoff, and it's just the bullshit show, and that's all we do. That's what it is now. It's not the Punk News podcast. It's the bullshit show.
Should we have more guests, do you think?
More
interviews or less? See, honestly, like, interviews are fun, but the problem is it's so like you have to start and restop every time. You know, like when it's just you and me, or you, me, and Sam, or you, me, and Hallie, more. And we can just hop on and start rapping. But like when you have like a guest on, you kind of have to, it's like when you have a guest over your house, you have to be a little bit more formal, you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. I think I like the spacing of guests we have right now, like for interviews. I think it would be kind of cool to have somebody that maybe we've had on the show a couple times, or somebody that we have more of like a, they've been over to our house a couple times, so they're very like comfortable getting stuff from the fridge without asking us, you know?
Yeah.
And kind of have like them come in as like a third host or a fourth host. Like, that would be kind of fun, like every so often, and just see how that went. And keep it on like a rotating basis. Like, I think that would be really fun. But I like the frequency of the interviews, where it's a good amount, but it's not too much, and you can really enjoy them when they're happening, you know, instead of being like thinking about next week.
Yeah.
And like, oh, what am I going to ask? Or like, how am I going to like word this or whatever? So that's what I'd say. I do want to do something, because we do have like the Punk News podcast, email thing. It might be kind of fun to have like a couple episodes where we involve the listeners, like, you know, write in and we'll give you really bad advice or really good advice or something like that, because I think that'd be kind of funny. There was one episode, I don't remember what it was, but I think it was an old Punk's Points that I was listening to a while ago, and it was like all readers and stuff.
Oh, with Punk's Points? Yeah, we do Punk's Points with readers. The problem is like one person will always come on and just dominate, just totally dominate. And like the other people are not having any fun just because they're getting their ass kicked, you know?
That's why we should have that, and then we should have Mikey Erg, because he, like, killed the last Punk's Points he was on.
Mikey Erg's real good.
Yeah, so it's like, win, and then try to beat him. It's like a tournament of champions, you know?
We could do Win Mikey Erg's Money, where people have to beat Mikey Erg. Well, yeah. we'll see. So it is a time of change on the Punk News Podcast, and so let's do what we always do. What are we gonna do tonight, Pinky or Brain? What is it? What are we gonna do tonight, Brain? Same thing we do every night, Pinky. Do the Punk News Podcast. And would you get that reference at all?
I remember watching the show. Yeah, it's the mic. Okay,
fair enough. On Animaniacs. Anyways, here's something that is also perennially around. And more, for the first time in 33 years, the sales of new vinyl have surpassed the sales of new physical CDs in terms of units sold. I believe the dollar amount was actually crossed a couple of years ago. In 2022, according to an RIAA report, 41 million new vinyl records were sold in 2022, where only 31 million CDs were sold. Digital downloads, of course, dropped again 20% to 492 million. Also the amount of, do we have the dollar amount for records sold? So dollar amount of records sold is 1.2 billion. However, of course, streaming is still dominating the market. Streaming grew 7% to a revenue high of 13.3 billion. One thing that I think you kind of have to quantify about streaming versus physical sales, although I don't know if it matters from the business standpoint, is that new records sold is mainly new records and perennial sellers. You know, Fleetwood Mac, Beatles, London Calling, and so forth. Where streaming, that's anything anybody wants to listen to ever, even if it's not popular. You know, so I think there's probably some dynamic there. But at any rate, what is also interesting is vinyl, even 3 or 4 years ago, vinyl was just a fraction of the amount of music revenue, but now it's about 10%, which is substantial when we're talking $1.2 billion. It's also interesting that really that music only pull in about $16 billion in a year, which seems kind of low, honestly, to tell you the truth. It seems pretty low, but I guess that's just America, so it still seems low. At any rate, so the vinyl trend is continuing after about, let's see here now, after about 10 years now, I think, vinyls have been increasing in sales. So I've been saying the vinyl fad is going to drop out anytime. I still feel like it has, but the numbers definitely disagree. And more, do you think the vinyl rage is going to continue? Is it going to continue to climb? Or are we at the height of the vinyl renaissance, if you will?
It's so hard to say because, like, have you seen those pictures of, like, Adele's album, and it's, like, stacks of them, and they're just hanging out. Like, nobody's buying them. They're just there.
I have seen that, but I would actually counter, and because I think those – so what Bam's referencing is there's a bunch of photos going around of Adele and Goodwill, like, brand-new Adele records. Yeah. And the big thing was is that Adele pressed, like, a million records or literally, like, a million records or something, which is kind of cool that someone sent in 2023 selling a million physical records. Back in the 90s, a million CDs is, like Backstreet Boys back in the day was sold, like, 10 million CDs in a week, literally. But that being said, it's 1997. But I would argue that those photos might be misleading in that, sure, there's a lot of Adele records left over at Goodwill, but like maybe she sold a million and there's 30,000 floating around Goodwill, you see. That means vast majority have been sold and only a pinch were left over, which if you are selling a product, hypothetically you want one unit left over, That way you know you sold every single unit you could sell, you know, whereas if you have no units left over, it means you've lost sales. So hypothetically, let's say there's 20,000 Adele records out of a million. That's a phenomenal success. So just because there's Adele records in the thrift shop doesn't mean that it was a failure or Adele ordered too much. Maybe she did. I don't know. But what I am saying, it could be that they sold almost all their copies and they just liquidated the last 20,000 of goodwill, which would mean that Adele made the right move. You know, and I know a lot of people say Adele's clogging up the pressing plant. And I would argue, no, Adele's not clogging up the pressing plant. Adele and Taylor Swift are keeping the pressing plants in business. And if this vinyl resurgence continues, then we should open more pressing plants. You shouldn't get mad. I mean, because the fact of the matter is like let me just use, No Means No is a rad band, right? And they're pressing the records. They're going to sell, what, 3,000 copies? Are 3,000 copies going to keep a record pressing plant in the business? No. Adele's million will. Yeah. And so if the drawback is that we got to wait a little while because of Adele, well, then that's your only option because otherwise the pressing plant won't exist. If the record mania continues, then hypothetically more record plants will get built and then time will speed back up again. I mean – we have a sudden unexpected growth in vinyl over the past 5 or 6 years. And so the market is still adjusting to that. And so, yeah, it's a bummer that like guys like Asian Man Records have to wait for a year for a record to get pressed. And that sucks. But we as fans could pre-order and wait a year to get a record, which really, you know, it's kind of a nice present. You get a year later, you get a Jesse Michaels record or something. Because otherwise, if Adele's popularity wasn't there, the record plants would not be in business, frankly. So I'm sorry, Em, go ahead.
No, that's a good point because, I just mentioned that because it's, you know, how many people outside of, like, very vinyl-dominant genres like punk are buying records kind of thing, right? But, I think it's good that it's getting more press and more people, like, are enjoying it because, obviously, like, that everyone wins when that happens. But I was thinking about it and it's like, well, why has vinyl jumped? And I really think it has something to do with the pandemic, because during the pandemic, what did you have time to do? You had time to sit and you had time to listen to music and you had time to either if you had an existing record collection, revisit it, or if you had never listened to a vinyl record before, you had that space and time to find one or buy one or whatever and listen to it. So I think a lot of people during that time kind of rediscovered the joys of like physical media, and I think that's going to continue. Definitely. I personally like CDs. I don't have any vinyl business. It's a lot of it's very, very pretty and very cool, and I've listened to vinyl and it sounds like killer, but I am more of a CD person. Because they're more portable, you can do like a lot of stuff with them, but that's neither here nor there. I do think it's going to continue because, again, streaming, you don't own your stuff. You can't choose. If you're on a free plan, say you're on a free plan at Spotify, and Spotify sucks, we can all agree that there's lots of problems there. But if you're on a free plan at Spotify, you can't even choose what you listen to. Like your playlists are like you get so many skips or whatever. You have ads, you have a lot working against you when all you want to do is just enjoy music. And instead it's turned into just sit here and we're going to try to sell you shit, you know? So I think non-digital media is going to make a huge comeback. Also, some MP3s are very lossy. So if you listen to some older, like, digital media, it's not going to hold up as well as, say, like, you know, physical media.
Well, here, like you said, I do think that the physical record thing is good. I mean, I love CDs, I love records. I like them about the same. I think it's cool that records are back, and I think it's cool that so many records are getting – like, people complain about records getting repressed, but I think it's kind of cool how, like, every record ever is getting repressed and all these obscure records are getting repressed. And I think we really are kind of in a golden age of records, and I think it's cool that records are selling so well, and I think it's cool that people appreciate records and artists, and that – I think it's kind of – you know – we're going to talk about a bummer a little bit later on the podcast, and in music we often do focus on bummer stories just for whatever reason, because I guess it's like a happy story. Wow, isn't this great? But this is great. It's awesome that people are buying records and bands are selling records, and that's rad and cool and awesome. You know what I mean? So There you go.
Yeah, go buy records. Oh, yeah.
Go buy records and buy them from me in Philadelphia on August on April 29 at the Philly Record Freakout, and also on April 1 and 2 at the Philadelphia Punk Rock Flea Market, where I will be selling records. So come buy from me. I got a lot for sale. Here's something a bit more vague. Love and Rockets are going on tour. And, of course, who are Love and Rockets? Love and Rockets are Bauhaus minus Peter Murphy. Bauhaus canceled the 2022 tour because Peter Murphy had to go on to rehab. And then really only a couple months later, Peter Murphy said, I'm back, and I'm going on tour with Adrian Blue, and we're doing a David Bowie tribute tour, which is very cool, and I'm going to, and I'm very excited for. Meanwhile, Love and Rockets, which is Bauhaus minus Peter Murphy, are going on tours too. It's a short tour. It's only like 5 dates. But, A, do people like Love and Rockets? B, if Peter Murphy's touring and Love and Rockets are touring, why don't we have the resumed or reconjiggered Bauhaus tour? Like, why are they still separate, if you will? And more, what's your speculation?
I think they just really hate each other.
I think you're right.
I think that's it. Yeah, because just the timing of everything, too, right? Like, it's, oh, yep, sorry, gotta cancel a tour and everything, and hope he got everything he needed treatment-wise and is doing well and is all raring to go. But then, yeah, I'm going to go do this really cool thing. And then the rest of the band's like, okay, cool, we're going to go do this really cool thing. I know this isn't going to happen in any universe, but it would be so funny if one of them, like, opened for the other, like, at a show. Or they're playing the same place somehow, like, just some, like kind of Parent Trap shit, you know? That would be so, so funny. But, yeah, Love and Rockets are a band that I always forget about. And this was the story on the podcast. It's like, oh, yeah, I know them. I gotta, like, listen to a couple, like, songs or whatever. So I did. And it's like, yeah, they're good. They're not bad. They're pretty, pretty cool. But yeah, is this tour like the beginning of, or do you think this tour is the beginning of a bigger Love and Rockets tour? Or do you think this is a, we're filling time while Peter Murphy does his thing, and, when we're done doing our thing and he's done doing his thing, we're gonna try Bauhaus again?
Well, I hope it's not a bigger Love and Rockets tour, because Love and Rockets is boring. I mean, wow. Honestly, Peter Murphy solo is boring. The only good Peter Murphy album is Line, which actually is a really good album. But, like, some bands, like, when the individual members go do their own thing, it's kind of cool. Maybe it's not quite as cool as the band, and sometimes it's cooler, but, like, you know, when the Beatles broke up, you know, Paul McCartney, he's got some cool stuff. Lennon's got some cool stuff. Harrison's got some cool stuff. Even Ringo's got some cool stuff, you know. Stone solo, Mick's got some kind of cool albums. Keith's got some okay albums. Vivian Girls, when they split up, Kathy Ramone did her cool stuff. Katie Goodman did her cool stuff. Sleep, when Sleep split up, Al Cisneros did Ohm, which was very cool. And Matt Pike did High on Fire, which is very cool.
Yeah.
With Bauhaus, when they split up, you get these astoundingly boring Peter Murphy records and these astoundingly boring and aimless Love and Rockets album and Tones on Tail records. And I'm like, how did one of the greatest bands, like together, they're like one of the greatest bands ever. And then, like, separate, they're just the most boring stuff I've ever heard in my entire life. You would think there'd be like one song in there that'd be like at least really good. And it just isn't there. It just isn't there. I'm astounded of the chemistry of that band, and maybe that is why they hate each other, because they know they need each other, and there is that kind of confrontational magic. But, like, just separate, yeah. All of them are just so boring. Like, I've tried to listen to Peter Murphy's solo records, like, many, many times, and I even have – I was so dedicated to it that I even got the Peter Murphy solo records box set for $20 – at Princeton Record Exchange. I'm like, well, maybe I need it remastered with all the bonus tracks and, you know, put it in a nice, you know, a nice order. Oh, I can't get past three songs. It's bad.
Oh, no.
So there are people that, like, love, well, Chuck Tikowski of Black Flag loves Love and Rockets. And I'm like, what are you hearing in this? It's just aimless, like blinking and blooping and blop, like bloop bloop bloop. It's boring. Anyways, I'm beating that on them pretty badly, which probably isn't quite deserved, but it definitely, to me, it definitely is them saying to Peter Murphy, you think we need you, but we don't need you. We can do Love and Rockets. And the fact of the matter is they need each other. I'm not sure who needs the other more. They both need each other like badly because they both make terrible music separate. But financial tour wise, Peter Murphy can do a solo tour, but he does theaters, smaller theaters, where Bauhaus does big theaters. Love and Rockets is smaller theaters too. So yeah, I don't know, man. I guess they might have that weird thing where like together. They've kind of got the Danzig thing going, which was I was surprised why whenever a Misfits tour happened, because Peter Murphy does a small theater, he gets 100% of the money, right? He does a big theater, he only gets 25% of the money, hypothetically. You know, maybe he doesn't, maybe he gets more, you know, but sure. Guessing. So does Bauhaus play shows that are at least four times as big as Peter Murphy's solo? Maybe, but just barely maybe. You know, so
if they try touring again, it should be called the Confrontational Magic Tour, because that was a great description.
That actually would be a cool name for a tour. What a confrontational magic! It'd be great for Bauhaus. Anyways, in a bizarre set of circumstances, as bummed as I was, the Bauhaus tour was canceled. I was actually thrilled because. In a bizarre twist of events, I wound up with four tickets, and I had about $1,000 invested in that show. And I was like, oh, what did I do? So I was kind of happy to get all that money because I thought it would sell out for sure. What happened was I need to buy two tickets, and they were like $70 each. I'm like, wow, that's really cheap. But I bought them, but they were actually like really shitty tickets. So then I tried to get better tickets. I'm like, well, I'll just sell my shitty tickets. So I bought better tickets. But then the show didn't sell out, bizarrely. And so I'm like, oh, my God, I can't unload these things for anything, you know? And so I was kind of happy it got canceled. I got my money back. Anyways, I hope Bauhaus goes on tour. I really want to see him. Will I? I don't know, but I'm excited to see Peter Murphy sings David Bowie. And more, tell me about Desert Sharks.
Yeah! So Desert Sharks are a Brooklyn-based punk band. And in certain... like descriptions, they describe themselves as a gloom punk band, which just sounds really cool. So they've released a video for their new song Medusa. So the song's off their upcoming EP called The Tower, and that's going to be out later this month on Substitute Scene. So the video was directed by lead vocalist and bassist Stephanie Gunther, and it has like live footage of them playing at the Econo Lodge in Brooklyn too. So the video is like there's snakes and there's flowers and then there's flowers burning and there's live footage and there's band members in front of like projected flowers and projected lightning storms and moons and all sorts of stuff. So like the video is cool. The song is great because the song is telling the story of Medusa, so it's very like mythological, and it's really, really good the way that they craft the lyrics and everything. So if you don't know the story of Medusa, readers, I will launch in. This is Emmer's mythology, Greek mythology class 101, so strap in, I guess. So, of course, Medusa, she started out as a beautiful maiden, and then she was raped by Poseidon in Athena's temple, and Athena took offense to that and turned Medusa into a gorgon, who is a creature that has snakes for hair and can turn people to stone with their eyes. Super cool power. And then Perseus then beheads her so a king can marry his mother. The gods help him out. They give him like a mirror shield and all sorts of stuff so he won't get turned to stone. He can deflect it. So he beheads her. her head still has the power to turn people into stone, so he uses it as a weapon. He gifts it to Athena, who puts it on her shield. And that famous painting, I think it's by Caravaggio, where it's like Medusa's head on, like, it's very gruesome, like it's dripping blood and it's on a shield. That's what it is. It's on Athena's shield. And also when he killed her, she was pregnant. So Pegasus, the winged horse, and Chrysaor, the giant who has a golden sword, sprang from her body. So, yeah. And the what desert sharks are doing is they're using the song to highlight the power that Medusa had, and everything. So there's a very good quote with the video premiere on Punk News from Stephanie Gunther, the lead vocalist, which explains their interpretation of the song much better than I can. So I suggest you go read that now. But yeah, I love mythological stuff, and I love when bands take inspiration from that and their lyrics are very much the story and everything. But the song's also very cool, like sonically and stuff. Like, it's kind of like grungy, it's kind of doobie, there's like a bit of goth to it, vocals rock. It's a great song. I'm looking forward to the EP. John, what did you think of Medusa by Desert Sharks?
Oh, I hated it. No, actually, I thought it was real cool. I love the idea and topic of the song. I don't think that's ever been done, kind of subverting the point. Like, in Greek mythology, Medusa is kind of deep. Well, she's a demon, or demonized, however. Like, is a thing you'd be hated. Whereas in here, we get the story kind of put it in reverse, which I thought was really kind of cool and rad. And I think the song is cool and kind of grungy. And yeah, so I think it's cool. So let's play it. And we will come back and we will talk about Ticketmaster, something that should be destroyed by Medusa. We'll be right back. And we're back. Ticketmaster. Is Ticketmaster the absolute worst or the absolute worst?
The absolute worst. I think the only way Ticketmaster could get even worse is if the guy who owns Spotify owned that and then partnered with Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, Ticketmaster sucks. So anyway, here's the deal. So Ticketmaster over the past 4 or 5 years has introduced a thing called dynamic pricing. That is, if a whole bunch of people sign on to buy tickets when the tickets first go on sale, the Ticketmaster system will recognize, hey, this is a popular ticket, and it will unilaterally move, say, a $75 ticket up to $150 or even $600. Famously, Bruce Springsteen had a debacle where, like, $100 tickets were like $800 on Ticketmaster, which is the working class musician is selling $800 tickets. Anyways, so Robert Smith of The Cure, who is not the working class musician, but is a cooler guy than Springsteen by far, said, all right, Ticketmaster, I'll sell my tickets on Ticketmaster, but I demand static ticket pricing and no dynamic ticket pricing. That is, when my tickets go on sale, the price will be the price and that will be that. And so Ticketmaster said, okay, Robert Smith, we're going to do that. And so tickets went on sale. And what happened then, Moore?
Ticketmaster didn't keep their end of the bargain and jacked up the fees.
Well, they sort of did keep their end of the bargain. They did the letter of the law, not the spirit of the law. So Ticketmaster didn't raise the price of the tickets. They doubled and even some instances quadrupled their processing fee. People were literally buying $80 tickets and getting charged $170-some because the processing fees were literally more than double were more than 100% times the ticket fee. That is, the processing fee was more than the actual price of the ticket. I had like an $80 ticket, $150 ticket, which was absolutely obscene. Robert Smith was real mad about that, and he issued a statement. He said it's bullshit and he's going to try to do something, but he doesn't know what he can do. Just about an hour ago or so, Ticketmaster reissued some of the exorbitant processing fees to some people, which only goes to show it was a complete scam to begin with, you know. But we all know it's a huge scam, because Eventbrite, Edmore, what do you think? So if I buy a $25 ticket, actually, if I bought a $25 ticket for The Cure, what would my processing fees be, Em?
On Ticketmaster or on Eventbrite?
Ticketmaster.
Oh, God. $200.
No, like $30. So 25 plus 30, $55, right? If I bought any other thing than the Cure, like the Circle Jerks, if I bought a $25 ticket, what would my processing fee be on Ticketmaster?
Higher.
Oh, no, about $18. So like 70%, 60%, right?
Oh, this is the dynamic pricing.
No. I mean, even without dynamic pricing, I'm saying just like if you buy.
Okay.
So they jacked it. They unilaterally jacked up the processing fee without any reason whatsoever. Right. For The Cure.
Yes. For
any other show before The Cure, it'd be like $18 on a $25 ticket, which is absolutely obscene. I mean, it really is. Do you know what Eventbrite charges for a $25 ticket?
Oh, isn't it something like $5 or less?
$1.50. $1.50.
That's really good. You know what good. I
mean? So it only costs Eventbrite $1.50 on a $25 ticket, but Ticketmaster either 18 or even 25 or 30, which is just beyond the pale obscene. And it just goes like the whole thing with Ticketmaster is when Ticketmaster joined with Live Nation, there was all these congressional hearings. Well, we don't want you to become a monopoly. And Ticketmaster says, we're not going to be a monopoly. And then the Congress said, well, OK, you have to sell one tiny portion of your company and you can't like sell tickets through like third parties under certain circumstances. And then Ticketmaster did sell that. And then did Congress penalize them? No, they just amended their agreement with Ticketmaster, allowed them to do what they wanted to do in the first place. It is so clearly a monopoly. Here's proof that it's a monopoly is under the idea of an open market. If you don't like a service or a product, you can go somewhere else to get the service or the product. Yeah. Robert Smith cannot show a Cure show. Robert Smith is so tied into one company that he can't go anywhere else. He's actively waging a campaign against the company he is using because there's no other company that he can use. You see, that's the definition of a monopoly. It is so astoundingly grotesque. And as I've said before, this is just the tip of the iceberg. If you think this is bad, you ought to see what's going on with medicine companies, with healthcare, and so forth. It really is scary and a bummer. And is Ticketmaster going to change? Probably not. I mean, this goes to show if people complain enough that if the artist gives the Ticketmaster pressure, they will cave a little bit, but they're still making obscene amounts of money. The best way to vote is to vote with your dollar or just to sneak in. But that being said, is and more, I don't want to be too pessimistic or negative. I feel we're beyond the tipping point. Can things ever turn around and things be fair ever again? Like, are we beyond the tipping point? I mean, this is grotesque.
Yeah.
Ticketmaster is literally charging more than double the ticket price just for processing fee when literally all they do is say, okay, you are in B17. That's all they do. Literally. They don't even mail you a ticket anymore. They put it on your phone. They don't even mail you a physical ticket. All they literally do is say, you're B17. That's it. Like, that's all they do. They don't run the venue. I mean, they own the venue, but that's a whole separate company. But they don't run the venue. They don't run the concession. They don't show you to your seat. They don't do security. That's all they do when they're getting $80 on an $80 ticket. Like, that is obscene.
It's beyond disgusting. Well,
yeah, right. So are we beyond the tipping point, M. Moore? What if M. Moore's like, no, I think that's cool. You know, I'm a total capitalist. And if you don't like it, you can start your own ticket company, you know. But, I mean, are we beyond the tipping point? Is it the end? What's the deal, M? Is it end period capitalism? Where are we at?
We are definitely at late stage capitalism with so much shit. Like, I mean, look at grocery prices, like especially in Canada, because we don't have many like large, or we have a lot of large grocery chains that are owned by the same people. So have you heard of Galen Weston?
Have I? No.
Okay. So he is part of the Weston family, and the Weston family runs Loblaws. Loblaws is one of the largest, if not the largest, Canadian grocery chain in Canada. And they're so big that in a lot of places, especially where I am, the closest supermarket, the closest grocery you can get to is owned by Loblaws. So what they did with inflation and all that, business is they have a brand of products called No Name, and No Name is supposed to be like the simplest product and the cheapest product you can get. What they did is they upped the prices, then they did a price freeze. So it made it look like they were saving consumers money when in actuality they were not, and they raised the prices of everything else and jacked up a lot of stuff that didn't need to be. So a little while ago now, there was a picture that went viral, and it was of chicken breasts in store, and it was like $50 for like four. Okay.
Oh,
it is disgusting. It is so gross. And because again, there's no competition. They can just do this. Like, they can arbitrarily raise or lower prices. They announced that the No Name price freeze, and I'm using price freeze in air quotes here because it wasn't an actual price freeze, is gone. So everything is like getting really, really expensive. They were called in, the heads of all of the very large chains were called in to be questioned and everything, and that's something that's ongoing right now. And you know, like, they have the gall to say like, oh well, it's not our fault that prices are higher. Meanwhile, their profit margins have risen I don't even know the amount, like something absolutely wild. They've made so much money while people are like literally having to choose between putting food on the table or keeping their lights on, and it's absolutely disgusting. So like, monopolies in any way are bad, and all they do is hurt people, and the people that benefit from it shouldn't benefit from it, because it's like, this is... They shouldn't be allowed to benefit from it because they've, like, you know, cornered the market. There should be able to be healthy competition. There should be other avenues, like for ticketing and for cell phone providers and for, like, you know, food. It shouldn't all fall to one, because again, nobody benefits. Like, it's gross and it needs to be broken up. Like, they're taking something, like with Ticketmaster, they're taking something that a lot of people look forward to, and a lot of people, like, live music is so important because it brings people together and it gives you hope and it gives you fun and something to do, and a very, very positive environment that, like, is nourishing in its own way. And to hold that, like, dangling the carrot above, like, you know, people being like, haha, jump for the carrot, and then they yank it away or whatever, like, it doesn't make any sense. They're only out for themselves, and we need to stop monopolies. That's my long-winded spiel.
Well, listen, I agree. it really is sick how so many companies benefited so much from COVID. Like, COVID was, like so hard on so many people, and companies were like, oh, this is a great time to really squeeze the neck. You know, it's, like, so messed up. It really is. You know what I mean? It's messed up, man. So I hope it's not too late. I don't feel good about a lot of things like that. So we'll see. Here's something else I don't feel too good about. The co-defendants have released a video for Fast Ones. It features D.O.C., who, of course, famously is a very iconic rapper. He wrote most of Dr. Dre's raps in N.W.A. Ice Cube wrote some of them, too. But he wrote almost all of Dr. Dre's raps on the Chronic and other Dr. Dre records. Apparently, he, like, lives down the street from Fat Mike and Beggars or something, and that's why he's part of the co-defendants is Fat Mike, one of the guys from Get Dead, and I guess a couple other guys, I guess, and more. The audience was very split on this. Some people loved this video and song. Some people thought it was not that good. What did you think?
I haven't been, like, the world's biggest fan of a lot of the co-defendant stuff. Like, it's cool and it's different, and I appreciate that they're doing something that excuse me, is very, well, not very different, but, like, is something you don't hear a lot of. I think that's really cool. But yeah, I don't know. There's just something I can't fully get into it, and I don't know why. Like, I've listened to, like, this song, and, you know, like, twice, today, like for prep for the podcast. I listened to it a couple times like before, and I can't get into it. Like, the music is good. Like, the chorus, the way it's sung is good for the song. The like, the rap parts are very good because like the flow is are mixed up and they are very good. I don't know, there's just something about it. The video, it's like all their videos are like episode whatever, so this was like episode 5, so it kind of keeps something like ongoing, which I thought was kind of fun. But I don't know, like the video, and the video is making like good points about problems in policing and stuff like that, but there is just something about it that seemed like maybe it was trying a bit too hard, or was trying to be something that it wasn't.
Really?
Or yeah, I kind of got that. I don't know.
Really?
Though. A little bit.
Really? You thought a bunch of white guys rapping while adopting a South Central LA affectation wasn't genuine? Wow. I mean, listen, the DOC's cool, man.
Yeah, he's cool.
A lot of people might not really, the reason the DOC's voice, the DOC actually had a really cool album called No One Can Do It Better. And then not that long after, he was in a really bad car accident where his vocal cords got crushed. And that's why he sounds like that. Actually, he should sound a lot worse. So I'm glad to see that his voice is getting better, or did get better. But listen, I mean, yeah. I'm not going to say you shouldn't rap if you're white, but I'm saying you better be really, really good and really unique. And I mean, I'm saying if you're really good, really unique, and not like just wholesale steal from Wu-Tang or even one of these modern rappers. It's like, what annoyed me about a lot of the rapping here is outside of the DOC is the rappers are like doing, they're doing a lot of mumble rap style rap or trap house style rap. It's like,
yeah.
A, that's not you. B, it's kind of cool. Like it's really corny when a white guy tries to pretend he's like a black. And the funny part is they get it. Like, if you listen to like a white guy rapping, trying to rap like a black guy would rap, is their slang and style is always like 5 to 10 years out of date. You know what I mean? Like a guy used to go to like rap battles in San Jose, and there would be like, well, actually, white and other non-black people rapping using words they probably shouldn't use. Also they would like use words that like gat. And like homie and crib, and it's like, yeah, the Beastie Boys were using that in 1986 because it was 1986. It's at that time it was like 2007. It's like you if you listen to contemporary black artists, they don't rap like that, you know. And so to me, this just feels like white guys rapping for other white guys, which I'm not that interested in. I mean, I think the DOC is cool, but I thought the actual rapping was kind of corny, to tell you the truth. I just think it was like. I mean, like, there are some good white rappers, and I don't know if it's right to make it a racial thing, but hip-hop was invented by black people. You can't argue that. And so if people from outside the black culture are going to do it, which, I'm not the ambassador of hip-hop. You don't have an opportunity to call the shots, but I think you probably should do it tastefully, like the BC Boys did later on, like Run the Jewels. Even I'm not even a huge Eminem fan, but Eminem doesn't rap like anybody else. He raps like himself. You know, he's not trying to rap like Wu-Tang or Public Enemy. You know, Eminem started in the early 90s, so like he's not trying to like rap like Public Enemy or Ice-T or Tupac. He's rapping like he would rap, you know. And so I just think here it's a lot of white guys that might be competent because they've studied other rappers a whole lot, but they're trying to be other rappers and not be themselves, and I think that makes it kind of cheesy.
Yeah, like taking something effortless and turning into effortful.
Yeah, it seems like they're trying very hard. Very try hard, you know?
Yeah.
Ed, tell us about Scum. I've never heard of this band.
Yeah, okay. Well, neither had I. But there's a show called Sewer Spewer that's hosted by Chris Aitkins of Gutzer. And that, who are a Montreal-based punk band who rock, and you should go check them out. But yeah, he has a weekly show on, it's on punkrockradio.ca now. And you can listen to like back episodes and whatever. So, I usually can't listen to it live. So I was listening to, one of the episodes, like catching up, and he's like, a song started the episode, and I'm like, oh wow, this is cool. And he came on and like introduced it and was like, yeah, this is from like Montreal hardcore punks Scum. They're re-releasing their debut EP or their debut LP, their only album. It's a big piece of like Montreal punk history. So I was like, wow, that's really cool. And one thing too that he mentioned was the reason why the periods are like that is because the Montreal police, their name used to be CUM. So Scum, the name of the band, because it's S, C, and then it's dot U, dot M, was like a play on that. So I thought that was really cool. So anyway, looked up the band. There's not a whole lot of information about the band, but they were a hardcore band in Montreal. They started in the late 70s. They released their album called Born Too Soon in the early 80s, and Porterhouse Records just re-released it. So the re-released version's available on Bandcamp, and it's available on vinyl, and on Bandcamp it's very good. And they also released a video for Pool Hunt, and that video features a lot of skate footage and a lot of still photographs of the band playing live when they were active. So I really liked the video because I thought it was cool and showcased a lot of different history stuff. The album is very good. They are very like notable for sure because they are like exploring police brutality. They're exploring a lot of like different issues that were going on like at that time and going on now as well. And yeah, they're just a very cool band, and it just astounds me how there are so many bands that are so interesting and so pivotal and so important, like within the punk scene, who existed for a relatively short period of time and didn't put out a whole lot of recordings, and but had such an impact on people, and only certain people like know about them or knew about them, or like they knew about them because they saw them live, or they knew about them because like their cousin or their brother or their sister gave them a tape, and that's the only way they know, like all of these like word of mouth things, which I think so cool that these bands reissue like their album or their EP or whatever, in this case it's an album, and introduce themselves to a whole new like set of ears who have never heard of the band before. And I'm so glad I checked out like listened to the radio show like that week, because it was like, oh my god, this is such an interesting band. And it's yeah, like John, what did you think?
Yeah, I thought it was real cool. It is crazy with punk, no matter how deep you dig, there's always cool bands to find, and there's always something cool just around the corner. And here's yet another long-lost band that, you know, we're at the vinyl resurgence right now, the vinyl renaissance, so stuff's getting printed back up that would have been lost to the ages, which is cool. We got one more story here, which is a sad story. Dick's Denny of the Weirdos has passed away. They didn't really give a whole lot about why he passed away, but, of course, the Weirdos are one of the most seminal punk bands of all time. Arguably the first LA punk band, or if not, then certainly one of the very first. They formed in 1975. They put out a couple of singles on Danger House Records, and they put out an album years in like 1990. But I got to see the Weirdos long past, I guess, their heyday. But I got to see them at Punk Rock Bowling like 3 years ago, and they were really, really cool. They did Helium Bar. They only have like 15 songs or something, but they were really cool. Definitely a great band, and definitely, I mean, Ron Ray has talked about how, like, because they kind of were at the very, very beginning of punk, like, they would wear, like, these weird clothes and stuff and play weird music, and they were kind of aren't punks because, like, the concept of punk hadn't been codified. Like, you should wear all black, or you should wear this, or you should be in a self-destruction, or any of this kind of stuff. They were kind of – they definitely were forebears of punk rock and formed as a punk band before there were any punk rockers out there. So, amazing band. R.I.P. Dick Steady.
Yeah, the Weirdos rock. Like, I was surprised when – like the In Memoriam piece rang, because I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't know, like, you know, like that's really too bad. But like, again, they made great work, and he made great work with them, and that'll live forever, and there'll be so many people who hear it and are inspired by it, and you know, like, many people will be inspired. Just, yeah, it's very sad, and definitely rest in peace, Dick Steny. Thanks again for existing.
Okay, let's play some Weirdos, and we'll see you next week, and who knows what the future will bring.